Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's episode of Work Life Stories. I'm Anna Richards, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Jane Ruff. Jane is the founder of Parenting Point, the coaching consultancy for parents. She's an occupational psychologist, and she's mum to two young boys. She's also the co-author of a new parenting book, which launches next month, in which she pens a chapter about the Holy Grail for working parents, finding the right balance between work and home life. Jane, I'm so pleased to talk to you today ahead of the launch of your book in November. Tell me all about it.
Thanks, Anna. It's great to be here. So the book Imperfect Parenting, Honest Stories from Global Parents, is a collection of real life stories from 12 parents from across the world, each talking about an area of parenting that is personally meaningful to them, from being a single parent to raising a child with disabilities to balancing work and home life, which is the chapter that I've contributed. And what we've aimed to do as a collection of 12 authors is create a resource for parents that offers some guidance through sharing the highs and lows of our own parenting journeys and the lessons along the way, a sense of connection, and hopefully some reassurance that there is no one size fits all way to parent.
That all holds so much value, doesn't it? I, you know, been lucky enough to read your chapter that you've written on balancing home and work, along with a couple of other sections of the book. And it's definitely sort of given me a bit of a trip down memory lane to my own maternity leaves when my children were very young. And, you know, feeling that camaraderie that you're in it with others is so powerful. It's when I first got in touch with Work Life Central, in fact, back then. And I think telling those stories is so valuable. And of course, in that chapter, you draw on your own experience of returning to work after your first child. Tell us about that experience for you and how that's sort of informed a lot of what you've done since.
Sure. So in a word, my return after my first son was born was tough, and it was a lot tougher than I had anticipated that it would be. From a practical perspective, I think I felt I'd done all the dutiful things that I should do ahead of the birth of my child. I'd been to all the antenatal classes, I'd done the reading, and professionally I had spent several years ahead of the birth of my first child's training as a psychologist, and reaching a point in my career where I felt that I had got to a place I was incredibly proud of. And perhaps naively, I thought that would be enough in helping me to feel confident returning to work, having reached that really important milestone personally in my career ahead of having my son Jamie. I thought that would be enough. And in reality, when it came to thinking about returning to work after he was born, it was the emotional impact of having to try and navigate and find balance between what were now two incredibly important parts of my life, my home life and my family life, and being a mother, and also a professional life that up until that point had been incredibly important to me and was still incredibly important to me. But I really struggled to see how I was going to get those two sides of me to exist together and to exist in harmony. And I found that I spent a lot of that early time in preparing to return to work fighting with a lot of emotion, and experiencing a lot of unanticipated emotion, which meant that even often quite innocent conversations I'd have about my return to work. I remember, for example, the settling in period for my son at nursery school, having a conversation with his key worker, who quite factually told me that he was going to be the youngest baby in the room. And that single comment stuck with me for such a long time. I dwelled on it, and I dwelled on the decisions that I was making about returning to work and the balance of work life and home life that I was seeking to create. And it took me a while to actually find a place where I was more accepting of the choices that I was making, and was in a place where I was able to work through those emotions. And I think coming into that as a psychologist as well, it was a really eye-opening experience for me that regardless of all the training and experience that I had in my professional field, navigating that change to become a parent and then a working parent, and then also navigating the continued balance of being a parent while also balancing professional life is incredibly tricky, and is something that warrants perhaps even more attention than it gets at the moment when we think about the different changes and transitions that we have to navigate in the workplace.
Absolutely. Thank you for telling me about it. I think the big word that you mentioned there is emotions, isn't it? Because there's so much practicalities that you have to think about, which is all consuming. You know, childcare is not an easy, you know, I was going to say problem to fix, doesn't need to be a problem, but, you know, working all those practicalities out are huge, aren't they? But then the emotions that go alongside it and the sort of shift in identity, really, and people try and tell you how big it's going to be, but you can't understand until it's you and you're there. So, you know, it's reassuring, I suppose, that we both felt similarly. Yeah. I'm sure that you speak to working parents professionally and personally. Do you think that those feelings, you know, are quite ubiquitous, really? What are the kind of pressures and challenges that people mention when they talk to you about that particular transition of returning to work?
There are a lot of similarities, definitely. There are a lot of common themes that come up in that conversation around returning to work. One of the frequent conversations that I have with clients is around that fear and concern around doing enough when returning to work. So essentially being found out for not doing enough, not being able to keep up anymore with the pace of working. And I think beyond that, actually feeling that you're not able to do enough at home as well. So again, back to this constant push and pull of the expectations that we're putting on ourselves around being the best that we can be at home for our family, and also then being the best that we can be when we turn up for work professionally. That feeling of imposter syndrome, both in the workplace and at home as well, is something that comes up time and time again. And I think what's quite interesting often around that is that it's not something new, particularly when we're thinking about it within a workplace context and perspective. Often when I'm speaking to clients and we're getting under the skin of what that feels like for them, there have been questions and personal challenges around self-belief and confidence before going on maternity leave as well. So often what we end up doing as part of that conversation is taking a different spin on it and reframing it and thinking about some of those challenges that we're experiencing as actually, within the context of returning after maternity leave, is actually an opportunity to do a bit of resetting of some of the challenges that we've faced before maternity leave as well, and an opportunity for development and growth. But that's a common challenge. I think another common emotion that is shared time and time again and that resonates with me personally is guilt and how we manage guilt. And I think what's interesting though about guilt is that it can appear in different guises as well. So I felt guilty about leaving my son at an early age in childcare. That was a guilt that really stuck with me. I've worked with individuals who've shared that they feel guilty because actually they're finding maternity leave pretty boring and they want to get back to work, and they feel guilty because they're saying that, and somehow they feel as if that's not the standard of parenting that they should be holding themselves up to. So I think what often comes out when we're talking about emotion around returning to work and emotion around being a working parent more broadly is we are experiencing this emotion internally, and often what is triggering that emotion are some of the external standards and expectations that we're holding ourselves up to? And often that is one of the challenges that we have to look to try and think about and address, not just when we're thinking about returning to work, but actually more broadly as well, when we're thinking about finding that work-life balance in general.
Interesting. Thank you. Yeah, and moving on, really thinking about your second maternity leave with all this knowledge and understanding that you'd gained from the first one in mind. I'd love to know how you approach that a little bit differently. I mean, for me, after my first, you've got a pretty young baby, still sleeping quite a lot. So actually, yes. I worked 4 days a week at that point, but I definitely did quite a lot of work on my day off because she was asleep. Yeah. Second time round is a whole different story, right? How did you approach your second maternity leave and then returning to work with all that knowledge and experience in mind?
Yeah, it's such a good question, and there's such value in hindsight, I think, with the second maternity leave. I think one of the building on the point around being aware of myself versus external expectations, there's definitely something around recognizing and accepting that each person's experience of maternity leave and returning to work is different and unique to them. And we all experience any change, whatever that change is, in our own unique way. So allowing myself to focus on me and what I needed and what I wanted from both my maternity leave and then also thinking about that return to work when that time came as well, was a really important shift in mindset to really focus in on what mattered most to me, what was important to me, and to recognize and appreciate that there were all other different ways and contexts and approaches on how things could be done. But I only needed to pay attention to what was going to serve me well and help me in my return to work. And I think that the build on that, I mean, what I tried to do by my second maternity leave was perhaps more so than I had done first time round, was tap into my own professional expertise in change more than I had even realized was relevant first time round. If I'm being perfectly honest, I hadn't joined the dots. One of the things that I would always talk about when looking at change in general is that we can't change what we can't see. And that was a very helpful framing for me to take into my second maternity leave. And that if I wasn't able to kind of take a step back and recognize and see the different emotions that I was experiencing and to what extent they were helpful and less helpful, then it was going to be very difficult for me to make some choices and decisions around how I wanted that return to work to play out this time round. So what I became really aware of, much more so than in the first maternity leave, were some of the stories that would play out in my mind. So some of the voices that I would hear in my head around what I was doing right or wrong in my maternity leave, and also when thinking about my return to work. So stories like, it's not going to be possible for you to keep up this time with both children and run two businesses. You know, that was a common story that would come into my mind. And what I became better at doing was taking a step back from that and saying, okay, well, where does it hold truth? Where is there truth in that story? And where is it actually going to hold me back from doing something that's important to me? I engaged a coach myself. So I worked with a coach second time round. I felt like I needed that external objective perspective, someone who was going to help me step away from the tangling of emotion that can sometimes happen when we're trying to balance work life and home life with a toddler and with all the emotion that comes with that change. I also, through that process, became a lot more accepting of experiencing the emotion, acknowledging it, and then actually being able to make a choice around what I wanted to do that was going to help me be the person I wanted to be as a mum and professionally as well. So there were some really small practical changes that I made in that second maternity leave. I actually enrolled on a professional development course that I'd always wanted to do. It was something that was a passion of mine. It didn't have a deadline or a time commitment to it. I could watch back the video recordings as and when I wanted. but I knew it was going to allow me to maintain a meaningful connection with my work. So there wasn't any expectation that I did it. I hadn't placed that expectation on myself either. It was something that I wanted to do that I felt would just help me maintain a degree of connection with why I do what I do at work and why it's important to me, and hold on to that element of my identity that quite honestly had got very lost in the first maternity leave. And it wasn't lost because it was no longer important. It just didn't know how to find its voice anymore. So that small change and just finding a small action that would help me stay connected really helped. And that's played out ongoing. So when I did return to work, I enjoyed a hot coffee and a croissant when I dropped the children off in childcare more than I think I have ever done in my life, because I could see the importance of that moment in actually finding a connection back to my identity as me, not as a mum, and at that point even not necessarily as a professional, just as me, as someone who likes coffee and croissants, and spending a little bit of, you know, time on myself. But even this week I had a situation where that guilt, that familiar guilt that started in maternity leave and has never gone away, and I don't think it ever does go away, the guilt of am I getting the balance right. I dropped my son off at Breakfast Club this week and he was not happy. He was distraught, and I obviously left the gate having all that emotional feeling of guilt that I then took on the train with me to work. And I sat with it on the way to work on the train and made a bit of a plan of action in my head on how I was going to manage that. I think in the previous maternity leave and return to work, I would have sat with that guilt all day, and that wasn't serving my son, who was at nursery school at that point, and there was nothing I could do about it. And it also wasn't helping me to be the professional I wanted to be either, because I was distracted by the guilt. So this time round, what I did was I sat with it on the train, and I made the decision that when I got off the train, I would call the school, check in with the school, ensure that he was okay. And once I heard that he was fine and I got that report from the teacher, that was enough for me to step back from that role for the rest of the day until it was time to pick up and focus and concentrate on what I wanted to do and what I wanted to achieve at work that day. So that's been a lot of work, though. That's not just been a shift in approaching one maternity leave to the next. I think it's been a much more holistic way of changing how I've thought about balancing work and home life more broadly over the course of the last 5 years. And the part that emotion will forever play in that, and how best to interact and engage with that emotion as and when it arises to make sure that it's not hindering the person that I ultimately want to be for my family and also within my career.
Fantastic. So interesting that, isn't it? Because with all the emotions and things that must have been going through your head on the train that day, all to do with the day you had coming up and all the just multitude of things that go around our heads, you were able to pick the one thing that could actually make you feel better and not let, presumably, possibly a feeling of, well, what the school think about me calling? Am I going to, you know, disrupt their days? Will they think I'm being a bit, I don't know, over worried or something like that? You can pick that action out that could help you. So tell me, Jane, professionally, I mean, there's so much there, isn't there, that you've obviously learned, and so many things that you did doing the professional work that you do. And as you rightly say in your book, there's no one size fits all here, is there? Mm. But when clients are talking to you about work-life balance, how do you go about advising them with that in mind? It must be very difficult. There's no flow diagram here, is there? There's no perfect plan for this. If there was, we'd all be fine. Yeah. But how do you go about that conversation then with clients?
Well, it's a great conversation to have with clients. And one of the places that we start is actually taking a step back to think about personal values and what is genuinely important to the individual. One of the quotes that I start my chapter in the book with is from Brené Brown: let go of who you think you're supposed to be, embrace who you are. And I think that's very much the philosophy that I would take in supporting a client to think about what work-life balance means for them, and also I think importantly means for them right now. as well, in recognition that I think we're on a journey of continuous rebalance. So not only is there no one size fits all solution, there's no one size fits all solution for us each as individuals either. We have to constantly reassess and reevaluate and rebalance. So if we can start by at least checking in and thinking about what we personally value right now, what is most important to us from a work life and a home life perspective, and almost use that as a bit of a guiding light to thinking about how we then go about prioritizing our time and choosing those small actions, like that action of, I'm going to call the school to check that my son is okay. If we can use our values to help guide us in that direction, rather than becoming consumed by the emotion, then that can be incredibly helpful. What that looks like in practice, when I'm working with clients, often that will be something as simple as getting someone to describe what their ideal day looks like when they are being, you know, how life would be ideally, and honestly, from a work life and a home life perspective. So we won't gloss over the challenges of getting out the door in the morning, or the struggles of a difficult conversation at work, but how, as an individual, you would like to show up to the good points in your day, and also the more difficult testing points, because that is the reality in which we live in. So getting someone to describe their day, I often write it down, maybe even write it in the form of a letter to themselves from their future self, is a really powerful way of getting someone to start to tune into and become much more aware of what they care about, rather than what they think they should be doing based on what they see others do, or what their perception of work-life balance is, based on what they've seen on social media, or they've read elsewhere. That is a really powerful starting point. And then I think another important factor of finding work-life balance, perhaps is challenging thinking about it as finding work-life balance, and instead looking at it as recognizing when the balance is about to tip. So it may be that we're never in a state of balance, and actually what's more important is recognizing when the overwhelm that we all experience when we are juggling an awful lot. So that overwhelm, which is a natural stress reaction to the fact that we are juggling to-do lists at home and at work, we've got lots of multiple responsibilities that we need to be able to manage and navigate. But that overwhelm, when it's there all the time and it becomes all-encompassing, that's when it's problematic. So finding and recognizing the points at which that balance is about to tip can be, again, an incredibly useful tool to work with people on. And there are strategies that you can put into place to do that. I think, first of all, recognizing how you might be responding to that overwhelm is important. So we all do that in different ways. Some of us might enter into a place where we're overthinking the challenges that we've got from a work-life balance perspective, to the point that through overthinking it, we're overinflating the problem and undervaluing our ability to find balance again. And that has a potential negative impact on our self-belief when we start to overthink and ruminate on what we're doing right and wrong. We might overreact as well. So again, if we think about that within the context of guilt, I forgot my child's school bag the other day, a common mistake. He should probably be remembering it himself. But if I was overthinking that and overreacting to that, again, that might turn into a belief that I can't do anything right. I can't, I've completely lost balance. I can't even remember a school bag, when in fact, it was just that day I forgot a school bag. It was just one of these things. Or we might do nothing and actually end up avoiding and retreating from situations where we think might tip the balance. So I think, first of all, recognizing where we might go to in our own heads when we start to, when that balance is starting to tip? Are we noticing some of those reactions? Are we overthinking? Are we overreacting? Or are we avoiding by doing nothing? And then looking at ways to tackle that. So finding, for example, ways in which we can break down what is on our to-do list and break that down in meaningful ways that again comes back to the values that are important to us. So I think what again can be a real challenge often is that our mind, as wonderful as it is, has this real capacity to create rules, and rules are helpful sometimes. So it's useful for us to know that a pound is worth more than a penny, for example. But if we start to create more arbitrary rules where we get hooked on stories in our mind that tell us things like, I should be staying late to make this meeting, or I must make every meal at home home cooked in order to make sure that everybody's eating a healthy diet, then sometimes what we need to be doing when we recognize that is breaking it down and thinking about the facts and assumptions, thinking about what is genuinely important to us, what's aligned to our values. And then if we have to choose where we're spending our time and our energy, deciding on the top three things on that to-do list that we're actually going to give our focus and attention to. So there are small steps that we can take to work towards what's important to us and our values in really practical ways. And I think it is often about taking the small step. So when we try and completely reevaluate and redo what work-life balance means to us, in itself, we're almost creating the unachievable task, when it's often much more effective to think about what is the small change that I can make that's going to have the greatest positive impact on my work-life balance and is also manageable for me to achieve right now. What does that small act look like? And that could be something as simple as, for example, saying, I'm overwhelmed by the amount of laundry that I have to do in my household, and I just cannot even face the thought of getting through the whole lot. But I'll put a timer on for 10 minutes on a Saturday morning, and I'll just see how much I get done. And that is a practical, actionable step that can help move you forward towards something that you want to do, something that you feel is going to help you find that balance. But it's achievable and it's actionable and it's avoiding that sense of overwhelm.
I love that, Jane. And actually, the piece that I love almost the most is thinking of work-life balance as not a kind of holy grail destination. That actually, let's assume we have it, and looking out for where it might tip. That's a real light bulb moment for me, actually, because as you say, otherwise we're making it an unachievable goal, aren't we?
Yeah.
And also, you know, we all have commercial business type brains, assuming most of our audience work in sort of corporate roles, which generally our members do. So let's apply quite a kind of, you know, quite a worky analysis to it, actually. Yeah. And it takes away some of the emotion, doesn't it? So I really love
Absolutely.
That. Jane, how important are boundaries in all of this, and how can we set those and respect them while keeping in mind the complicated life that we all lead, that they need to be a bit flexible? Boundaries have come up quite a lot recently when we've been talking about hybrid and remote working, of course, because taking the commute out can, you know, has a lot of positive outcomes, of course. But for a lot of people, it's a time to switch roles, decompress, have a bit of time out.
Yes.
What's your view on boundaries and the importance of them in this quest for work-life balance?
Yeah, no, I think that the conversation around boundaries is a really important one. And again, I think it is a topic that is talked about a lot. And my overarching perspective on boundaries is similar to making sure that when we're thinking about what's important to us from a work life and a home life perspective, that we focus on what we genuinely care about and what matters to us. The same by extension goes to what we set as our boundaries. So there is no one size fits all or right way to have a boundary or set a boundary. It should really be aligned to our values and what we care about and what matters most to us. A boundary is there to protect what is important to us. And I think remembering that is really key. Make sure that it's protecting what is important to you, and you set the boundary around that, rather than thinking that you need to have a particular boundary based on your way of working, for example, if you're in the hybrid office. I think in terms of the flexibility of boundaries, I feel quite strongly about this, that sometimes we need to be mindful of when holding a boundary too rigid can actually have the inverse effect on what we want it to achieve for us. So if we, for example, were to hold the boundary of not responding to emails outside of working hours too strongly, to the point that actually all it did was maintain an underlying level of anxiety that we knew it was waiting for us the next day, then we have a choice point that we need to make around whether actually it's serving us well to maintain that boundary, or whether on this occasion it might be the better option or choice to demonstrate a degree of flexibility. That is very person to person dependent though, and I think again boundaries is very much dependent on who you are and how you like to work. And if you are flexing your boundaries, if that's something that you allow space for, I think knowing it's in the short term and having a plan of action in when you're going to reset and recalibrate is important too. So you wouldn't want to flex a boundary and then have no plan of action in how you were going to reinstate that boundary if it genuinely was something that was important to you. And I think the final thing I would say on boundaries is have someone close to you hold you accountable to your boundaries as well. That's something that's worked really well personally for me as someone who has a tendency to allow work to bleed into home life. I'm fortunate to have a partner who values time outside of work greatly. And he is a great source of a check-in, and will be there to remind me that if I do set a boundary of making sure that I'm not working beyond what feels right and comfortable for me outside of working hours, that he will remind me of that. So having somebody close to you who you feel can hold you accountable to your boundaries, again, is a really helpful way of making sure that those boundaries are maintained.
That's a really nice one. Really nice one, and really important. And you talked, of course, about choice there. I'm really interested in this, and the feeling of kind of control of all the competing pressures in our lives. It's something that I've, you know, felt a lot in the past, and sometimes in the present as well, that we sort of feel pulled in all different directions, don't we? And and not really in control of any of it at times. And I remember a colleague, you know, saying to me, you know, the business will keep taking from you because assuming you're doing a good job, they're going to want you to do more and more of it until you say stop, until you say no. You're the only person that can do that. What's your advice for people that feel that out of control feeling?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is there is an element of control the controllables. So back to recognizing what is within your power and control, and then letting go of what is outside of your control, and really focusing your energy and attention on what you can challenge and change. Someone reminded me of an analogy the other day that I think summarizes the point on choice that we have around work-life balance really well, which is when we are juggling multiple balls, make sure it's the plastic ones that we drop and not the glass ones. And I think that to me is a really honest way of looking at work-life balance and control or not, as the case may be, because I think the reality when we are juggling so much is that balls do drop. And the balls will drop. We just want to make sure it's the right balls. And if we try and keep them all up in the air, then again, we might not be doing ourselves any favors mentally and psychologically in trying to keep the balls in the air all the time. So I think a really helpful exercise for people to do around that would actually be to think about what their own glass balls are. So what is important to them personally, linking that into their personal values from a professional perspective, from a work and home life perspective and beyond. What are the glass balls for their job as well. So recognizing that we will have some glass balls that we just can't drop in our role, and knowing what they are, and keeping those in mind. And in doing so, recognize the ones that maybe it's okay that we do, the plastic balls that are less important in our work. And perhaps most importantly, a glass ball that I think always gets missed and is fundamental to actually keeping work-life balance going completely is our self-care glass ball. And, you know, recognizing and remembering that if we aren't giving ourselves the space to think about how we feel and what's working for us and what's not, then actually we're not going to be doing ourselves any favors in that work life or that home life sphere. So really kind of taking a step back to think about the balls that you're juggling, and spending a bit of time thinking about those glass balls that you want to make sure you're keeping in the air, so that if a choice has to be made, it's a plastic one that drops, is I think a really helpful little analogy to keep in mind when we think about work-life balance.
Yeah, I agree. It's a lovely analogy. Really good way to think about life. Thank you so much, Jane. You've had so many wonderful pearls of wisdom for us today. I've loved hearing all of them. Have you got a final thought or suggestion that you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Yes, and if I can be cheeky, I'll take a couple of thoughts to leave you with. I think the first is, when it comes to work-life balance, see it as an ongoing experiment. So it's not about finding the one solution right now and not having any flexibility to change that. I'll often encourage people to think about it as, you know, seeing life as living in a perpetual beta state, or always being a work in progress, and viewing work-life balance as a bit of ongoing experimentation that we can learn from, that we can change and we can adapt. Again, I think just gives us permission to keep what works and also change what doesn't, and it'd be okay to make mistakes along the way in that journey of finding what works for us too. The second piece of advice linked to that would be to continue to cut out the noise around you and really stay focused and tuned into what matters most to you and your family. So bringing us right back again to the importance of values and spending some time really thinking about and reflecting on that, so that when it comes to making choices, you can feel more confident and empowered that those choices that you're making are moving you in a direction that matters to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again for talking to me today. I've absolutely loved hearing about all your thoughts and advice. It certainly got me thinking, and I'm sure it will have been of huge value to our listeners as well. If you'd like to find out more about Jane, you can visit her website, which is parenting-point.com. Her new book out in November is called Imperfect Parenting: Honest Stories from Global Parents. So do look that up. And to find out more about what's coming up in the Work Life Central program, do visit worklifecentral.com, and stay tuned for more from Work Life Central coming soon. Goodbye.